We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for March 24th, 2015. Senator Hoffman, Coon Rapids Tax Increment Financing, Senate Bill 1492.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1492. This bill is to extend a TIF district for the city of Coon Rapids, and with me coming up at the table is our Coon Rapids Mayor Jerry Cook and Matt Brown, who's the Community Development Director for Coon Rapids. Senate File 1492 is sought by the city of Coon Rapids and really is a goal to reboot a Coon Rapids TIF district that had the misfortune of being created in December of 2007, just as the economy took a tank. Coon Rapids invested significant effort and incurred some significant costs getting the district ready for redevelopment, only to have the recession throw cold water on the developer's interest and in the ability to invest in the district. So what 1492 does is just two things. Simply, it extends the life of the TIF district through 2038, and then it allows the current tax rate to be used for purposes of computing tax increment rather than tax rate of 2007. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our mayor, and then we'll stand by for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr.
Welcome,
Chair.
Mayor Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jerry Cook, Mayor of Coon Rapids, and I think Senator Hoffman pretty well explained it. It's a pretty simple process, and our community development specialist Matt Brown is here with us and could highlight any anything else or answer any questions you may have. Appreciate you looking at this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Brown. I'm Matt Brown, community development specialist for the city of Coon Rapids. And as Senator Hoffman said, it's a fairly straightforward ask. We're looking to extend this redevelopment TIF district for a period of 5 years, also make a change to the base value for the district for to change it to the current pay 15 tax value, since tax values in the area have dropped. And it's expected that that simple change will result in a fairly significant amount of additional revenue to the city. It was always envisioned that the city would use that tax increment to essentially repay itself for the costs incurred with significant land assembly, building demolition, contamination cleanup for this area that was done over a period of many years. We expect to have a developer on board very soon. The site has sat vacant for the last 10 years or so. It's about 30 acres. It's a big development priority for the city and could be transformative for a very significant corridor in the North Metro. In addition to assembling the land, the city invested a fair amount of resources in cleaning up contamination from an illegal dump and dry cleaning business at that location. So continued development of this area is very important to us.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Senator Hoffman, or which one of the testifiers, a couple questions. First of all, what was the original amount that was proposed to be raised by the original TIF district that you're now asking for the extension on?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, back in the mid-2000s, it was expected, and obviously it really depended on what the ultimate use of the site was. We had projected, you know, somewhere in the $7-9 million range. The city had initially put about $16 million into the site. We had always known going into it that we would never be reimbursed for all of those costs, but at least hope to be reimbursed for a fair amount of them through TIF.
And so, Mr. Brown, did I hear you say you've actually spent about $16 million?
That's the total, including all of the land acquisition, demolition, and cleanup costs.
Okay, and have you calculated how long the extension would have to be if you weren't able to freeze the tax rate?
If we weren't able to freeze the tax base, again, it depends a little bit what is ultimately developed there, but it would be expected that closer to $5 million or so may be raised.
Mr. Brown, my notes have that this proposal with the two changes would raise about $4.5 million.
Yep, that's about right. That's what we estimate.
And if we don't freeze the rate, how many years would the extension have to be to raise that $4.5 million? This extension
That $4.5 million would be with the five-year extension.
With the five-year extension.
Yep, that's right.
Without the rate freezing.
Without the rate freezing, the district would generate about a little over $5 million.
Okay.
That's what's projected.
Any questions, members? Oh, Mr. Brown, I'm asking the question the wrong direction.
Okay.
What would happen if the rate was unfrozen?
If the rate was unfrozen, so if you're asking if the rate were...
What would happen if the rate was not allowed to be the same as it currently is for the extension of the TIF?
Okay. If the rate was as it had been, as was originally approved with the district, the district would generate a little over $5 million.
I'm going to follow up with you further on that because
okay.
I'm not making it clear. You're proposing here that the rate be frozen at the current tax rate for the increment classification. And if we were to... Mr. Sylvia, would you help me?
Mr. Chair, members, the proposal is doing two things. It is extending the duration of the district for 5 years, but it's also allowing increment to be computed using the current tax rate rather than the original tax rate. So I think the question is, if the original tax rate portion of the bill wasn't in the proposal, would the district have to be extended additional over those 5 years that are being proposed in the current draft?
I see what you're asking.
Mr. Brown.
So you're asking if the base value was not changed, how many more years in addition to that five? Okay, I understand that. I don't have a good answer for that right now. Certainly, I could figure it out. But, I mean, it would be several more years, maybe another 5 years or so. I'd have to do some calculations to figure out exactly what that would be.
Okay. And we'll take a look at this and see where we think if that would be a better mechanism or not. So
okay.
We'll have to have further conversations with you and Senator Hoffman as to
yeah.
how we end up with, if we you can get where you want to go. Any questions, members? Senator Sanjan.
Mr. Chair, perhaps just a question, maybe not so much for the author, but maybe just counsel. When we talk about the using the so-called current tax rate as opposed to the original rate, and I haven't looked ahead in the other extensions, but is that common in terms of the way we write these, or is this an author preference?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sanjan, typically when we have bills before us that ask for duration extensions, it's just the duration extension.
Okay.
I believe this is only the third time that a bill is before the committee that is asking for the current local tax rate
okay.
that rather than the original tax rate be used.
Thank you.
And Senator Sanjan, you're asking the perfect question because what the issue is here is once we make an exemption for a project, no matter how large or how significant, it doesn't take long for the rest of the communities to come along and ask for exactly the same treatment. Hence the request from right. Coon Rapids right. now based on a Bloomington initiative that was of a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So precedents are important. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1492? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Hoffman. Any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you, and members, for the opportunity to get that blighted piece of property. Really used to be, I remember as a kid, going to that strip mall that is now a vacant piece of land, and it would be nice to see that get redeveloped.
Okay. We'll be in touch and see what we can work out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, lay Senate File 1492 over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Senator. Okay. Senator Cohn has a commitment that needs to be moved up, so we will move to Senator Cohen. Senate File 585. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much. This is kind of a unique request, and if I might offer a little bit of history to committee members. This is in regard to the closure of the St. Paul Ford plant and the request from the City of St. Paul to establish a TIF district, but not for purposes of economic development, but rather for purposes of the infrastructure work to be done at the front end. And members, if Mr. Chairman, members, if you'd allow me to just offer a touch of history. For those of you who are familiar with the geography of St. Paul, the Ford plant is in the far southwestern corner of the city, the far southwestern corner of my Senate district, and an unusual place for the location of a manufacturing plant, except when the plant opened, I believe it was 1924, everything was woods. And none of the housing development in that area developed basically until after World War II. So for years you had this very large manufacturing plant basically by itself in the city, and the city kind of grew up toward the plant. With the closure of the plant at this point, St. Paul finds itself with a very significant, huge piece of acreage, I think 122, 125 acres or so, which makes it potentially the largest economic development opportunity in that respect in an urban area in the United States. It was also very clear that Ford had made up their mind quite certainly to close the plant, and I can't speak for the economics of auto manufacturing in the country, but if we go back a few years ago, 1996, Ford announced they were going to close the plant. But there was some willingness to take a look at alternatives. And back then, myself, then Representative Howard Ornstein, Governor Carlson, Mayor Norm Coleman, and others talked to Ford about whether or not there might be some opportunity to do something that would allow the plant to remain open with, at that point, I think about 3,000 full-time workers. And that's when we put together the joint Minsky Ford training site, for instance, on the property. This time around was a little bit different. Ford basically had no interest, and I might be characterizing this unfairly, but there was no outreach from Ford to see if there was some alternative to closure when this was announced about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And, in fact, I think Governor Pawlenty went out to Detroit, and somebody might correct me if I'm misstating this, but I don't think he got very high up in terms of talking to folks at Ford about whether or not there would be an opportunity to do something else. So it was very clear that the handwriting was on the wall that this plant was going to close. The production of the Ford Ranger never really worked out, and the plant was going to be gone. So what that leaves is this immense piece of acreage, which, again, I still feel badly about the folks who lost their jobs, and I think by the time the plant closed, it was down to 2,000, some of whom were part-time workers. The flip side of the coin is that there is an economic development opportunity for St. Paul that is highly unusual. And the city is looking at a variety of uses for the property, housing, retail, commercial, just a wide variety of stuff and things that might be done to make this a very unique urban economic development center. But to get from here to there, you first have to take care of the remediation and deconstruction of the property. That's what's going on right now. And in fact, Senator Bach and I were there yesterday to tour the property, which looks a lot different from the area that I remember growing up, and since there's basically nothing there at this point. But it's going to be done in several phases. And to accomplish that, St. Paul is looking to establish a TIF district, which, again, I will emphasize, is not for purposes of economic development, but for purposes of dealing with the infrastructure. Probably the person who's most involved with this, Mr. Chairman, the bill is fairly simple. It allows the establishment of the TIF district pursuant to state law, and gives some provides an expiration date. The catch with the legislation this year is that given where things are progressing in terms of taking the site down, and obviously as folks can well imagine, the environmental issues are immense, because in 1924 and 25 and 30 and 35, when this plant was being built and expanded, nobody really gave any paid any attention to what was taking place in terms of environmental kinds of concerns. And so St. Paul, in fact, Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum can speak to this more directly than I can with what we've attempted to do with Rochester in these past this past year relative to the destination work in Rochester. This is a little bit different because the Rochester involvement is one which involves the centrality of the Mayo Clinic and then what emanates from that. This is an attempt to deal with what is a very vast urban acreage, which is just going to be sitting there. And absent the ability to do something this year, because of the timeline of the demolition of the plant, if we wait another year, it becomes probably too late and creates some fairly onerous difficulties for the city of St. Paul. So that's kind of the introduction, a little bit longer than I'd hoped. Probably the person most involved, I'm not sure who wants to start this off, but John, so Mr. Sage Martinson is the head of Sample Planning and Economic Development and is the staff director, probably spearheading most of this within the city, and can offer some details as to why we need this legislation this particular year.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. And Mr. Martinson, if you can walk us through why the city needs to have an extension on the meeting of the blight test, which you currently have, and then also what the city's thoughts are with regard to the multiple TIFs on the one site. Mr. Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jonathan Sage Martinson, the Director of Planning and Economic Development for the City of St. Paul, and Jenny Wolf, our DED Administrator from Planning and Economic Development, is here as well. Thanks for hearing the bill this morning, and thanks to Senator Cohen for carrying the bill. As mentioned, this file, this law change would do two things, two exceptions in the current TIF law for the Ford site. One would give us additional time, an additional 4 years to decide whether we're going to establish a TIF district and to establish it, and then the ability within the footprint of the Ford site to develop not one TIF district as law currently allows, but multiple TIF districts that would be smaller and sort of match the development of the site. So as you may know, and as Senator Cohen said, this site has really been under demolition since March 2013. We did a blight finding in February of 2013, found the vast majority of the buildings on the site as a blighting influence. Ford then began the demolition work, and today they have all the buildings down. They're still working on pulling up some of the subsurface structures and some of the slabs that are still there and doing environmental testing as they go, doing testing and more drilling as they pull up those slabs and have access to the dirt to view it and to do this additional testing. Ford Motor Company plans to put the property on the market towards the end of this year. And given past work they've done in other large redevelopment sites, we anticipate it'll take a couple of years for that developer to do due diligence to close on the property and to begin construction. So it will likely that we won't see any construction on the site till 2018 or later if all goes as quickly as it can go. And this is due to just the size of the site, 122 acres in the main parcel, 22 acres in the river parcel, as we call it. The vast majority of the main parcel was covered, as you can see in the map that I submitted, by slabs and buildings. So there's just an awful lot of work there in terms of the demolition environmental assessment. So one of the things we would have to do under current law is by March 2016, we'd have to establish a TIF district here if we were hoping to use that as a resource in the redevelopment. We're not going to know enough by March 2016. And so what we're asking for is in a four-year extension till 2020 to decide whether or not we need TIF and to certify that TIF district. The second part of this bill is to ask for the authority within this footprint of the Ford Motor Company property to do multiple TIF districts that would be within that same footprint. The way current law is written, given the blight findings that were done in 2013, we have the ability to create one large TIF district that covers the entire 144 acres from Ford. What we believe will happen as this site is redeveloped, we've been told it will likely develop over to 2 to 3 development cycles, so it could be 10, 15 years or so by the time the full site is developed. And the most efficient way, again, if we need TIF on the site for infrastructure, the most efficient way to use it is to size multiple smaller TIF districts that match those development cycles. So we're asking for the ability to do that, to roll out TIF essentially where we need it, when we need it. So it's a more surgical use of TIF rather than just sort of one blanket TIF district. So that's the second change, and as Senator Cohen said, our intent here really is to use it on the infrastructure. There's environmental pollution, we believe. We're still looking for that testing. We believe there is no infrastructure on the site, so all that will need to be built. And once we know more about the environmental and the developer coming in, we'll know more about the need to use TIF on this infrastructure piece. Both the school district and Ramsey County have been supportive of this. We think there's broad community support to give us this greater flexibility around use of TIF on the site. So thanks for your time, and Jenny and I and Senator Cohen can answer questions if you have them.
Mr. Sages Martinson, so the timeliness is because the 3-year time limit on meeting the blight test, that's hence the reason for this year's request.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yep. The demolition environmental testing is still going on, just given the size of the site.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cohen.
I just want to emphasize what Mr. Sage Martinson has mentioned, and that is that there's an element of who knows, and that's the reason for this the request for these exemptions. Because if members can kind of envision, again, the Ford plant, so at the edge of the plant you have fairly high-end housing on the River Boulevard. Then you've got the Ford site. The other side of it is commercial, the Highland Village area. And so there's this element of who knows what's going to happen in terms of will there be high-end housing, will there be rental housing, will there be commercial development, will there be more significant retail development? And there's a lot of uncertainty, which on one hand is exciting, but on the other hand puts the city in a difficult posture to be able to lay out exactly where things might be in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And as Mr. Sage Martinson pointed out, the thought is this is going to be a 10 to 15-year cycle. So I'll never get the chance to be around for the finish of it. But only at the front end.
And Senator Cohen, did you want to add something? The other testifier?
No, I don't need to.
Okay. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 585? Chair, Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, or either of your witnesses, I seem to understand that Ford is doing the demolition, so the TIF would not be used for demolition, but it would be used for the new infrastructure to prepare for strategically whatever might go there and different parcels.
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, that's our intention, is to use it for the infrastructure piece of the work. Ford is already well underway with the demolition and hopes to have that wrapped up this summer.
Seeing nothing else, thank you, Senator Cohen.
Chair
will lay Senate File 585 over for possible inclusion. Members, okay.
Members, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Members, we have a quorum. The minutes are here for the previous two meetings. If you would have an opportunity to review.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to adopt the I've got
which dates are they?
March 17th and March 19th, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Reinhart's moves the adoption of the minutes for March 17th and March 19th. Any errors, any omissions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. Senator Torres-Ray. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1575 on behalf of a portion of my district, and this is for the city of Richfield.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, this particular bill addresses a significant issue of an area in my district that is really competing for attention and struggles between the development of a really large district in Minneapolis and a large, powerful district in Bloomington. So they are kind of sandwiched by these two very powerful cities. And the city has to work very hard to really incentivize businesses to locate in Richfield. But this particular bill attempts to correct and to extend the TIF district for the city of Richfield that was instituted by the legislature in 2005 and is the Cedar Avenue TIF. And this particular provision was created, Mr. Chair and members, to address a significant issue and to stimulate redevelopment in the area that is located within approximately a half a mile of the 1735 north-south runway that was constructed at the Minneapolis St. Paul Airport in 2005. So when this particular runway was built, it was clear to the community and to the city and to the people involved in this process that the houses that were located in there were just not going to be able to withstand the noise. And so the airport bought 428 homes in order to build the runway. And that left, you know, the city with a significant challenge. And then the houses that are located around the runway continue to struggle with noise. At that time, the city, through this enactment of the Cedar Avenue TIF district, was able to develop a pretty significant portion to, I don't know if people are familiar with Richfield, but we have a Home Depot now, a Target, that is located in their area, and they did quite well at the beginning of the construction. But with the economy, this is not doing as well as we were hoping that they would. And so the city is now struggling to figure out what to do. And we are here, Mr. Chair and members, to ask for your support to extend the TIF district for that particular area. And with me today, I have the city manager who will be able to explain a little bit more the history and some of the issues that we are struggling today with the current development. And here is Mr. The Community Development Director, John Stark.
Mr. Stark.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having us. Senator Torres-Ray did a great job of giving you the background. Many of you may be familiar with the the airport's noise abatement program. You know, when the runway went in, they went through Minneapolis and Richfield and several other communities and noise-proofed homes. When it came to this proximity to the runway that we're talking about, which we refer to as the 87 decibel low-frequency noise area, the airport's consultants and City of Richfield's consultants all concluded that there was no amount of a noise abatement that could take care of the low-frequency noise. The high-frequency noise is the noise everybody hears from a jet.
And Mr. Stark, could you say your name for the record? It helps us identifying later on.
I'm sorry. It's John Stark, and I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Richfield.
Thank you, Mr. Stark.
Sorry.
Continue.
You know, the high-frequency noise is the noise any of us hear when an airplane is flying overhead. The low-frequency noise, the way I describe it, it's kind of like when you pull up at a stoplight next to a car that's playing rap music or music with heavy bass. You feel that bass thumping more than you hear it. And that's the nature of low-frequency noise. So the conclusion was that the traditional noise mitigation on these 1940s homes could not accommodate the low frequency noise. And so the solution was to acquire the homes. We're talking about quite a large area of Richfield. And over time, the city of Richfield has acquired 48 of those homes. They now sit vacant. We've also constructed about three blocks of Richfield Parkway, which ultimately is going to be about a 15-block roadway that's also going to accommodate the Three Rivers Park District's interurban trail. The legislature did approve this district by special legislation in 2005. Part of that was, you know, there was some general consensus at the legislature that Richfield was absorbing an inordinate burden for the airport. You know, it's really a regional and statewide benefit, but communities like Richfield were taking on more than their share of burden for that. Since the district went into effect, you know, this is a repeating theme that you heard from Coon Rapids, the economy went south, and development interest just hasn't been there. At this point, however, there is a great deal of development interest in the last 18 months or so, 12 to 18 months. When we talk to developers and run through the numbers, with the existing TIF district that we have that we've lost 10 years on, the fear is that there is going to be inadequate increment to overcome the financing gaps of acquiring the additional houses to do the development. So in recognition of that, we are asking for an additional 10 years to be added to the low-frequency noise TIF district. We are not asking that anything be done with the base value.
I understand.
So with that, I think we would take any questions.
Mr. Stark, as I asked the city of Coon Rapids, do you know how much you've spent on this? Do you have a feel for what you expected to raise and kind of where you're at with regard to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thus far, with the 48 homes that have been acquired, that cost roughly is about $8 million that's been spent so far on those homes. Also, the money that's been spent on Richfield Parkway has been approximately $1.5 million. So there's been a substantial amount of money expended. Now, I can't say that all of that came from the city of Richfield's coffers. When the airport went in through a settlement with the airport, some of that money was provided by the Airports Commission, some was provided by Hennepin County, and some was provided by Richfield. In terms of the amount of TIF to be generated, that is so dependent on the ultimate development that would come in that I don't have a great answer for you. We have a redevelopment plan for the area that, again, was done in 2005, and so it's a stale plan. It called for uses that may not make sense in today's economy. So we're going through the process of updating that plan. So I can't tell you the exact amount of increment that we would be expecting. It just would vary so much.
And so you don't really know if you need 10 years or 5 years because you really haven't got your analysis complete on what you might expect to raise. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, kind of like the St. Paul one that you heard before us, we anticipate that this would happen in phases. And the first phase that we're looking at is directly across the street from the Target and Home Depot. On that phase, right now we have six developers giving us proposals. And we've run TIF numbers on all six of those. And it varies. Some of it is depending on what the community wants. For example, senior housing development, the way that they pay taxes, the way that they pay for land, probably would need a lesser duration of increment. They might even be able to survive on the 15 years that's out there. The community doesn't want senior housing there. However, we have a great deal of senior housing. So when we say, well, we'd really like to have market rate housing and run those numbers, we would need the full 25 years for that. So that's an example of where it varies by the use.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stark. Any questions, members? Sarah Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking market rate housing, do you know what the rent, I mean, and this is kind of unrelated, but it is related in my mind, what is the market rate rent for those housing would be, which is versus the average rent in Richfield? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the The market rate rent, we feel, on the one hand, is going to be lower than market rate rent elsewhere in the community because a resident is ultimately living that close to the airport, and there's some price discount that would go with that. The construction costs, on the other hand, we feel are 10% higher because of having to make changes in construction techniques to accommodate the noise.
Anything else, members? We're looking up a little information about market rate housing in TIF districts because we are having some ongoing discussion about market rate housing in TIF districts. We actually have a bill on the agenda today dealing with that, so we're going to do a little research into that. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1575? Seeing none, nothing else, members. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Again, just a reminder of the particular nature of this area when we built homes, as Mr. Stark just alluded, that we have to make accommodations for the noise for the airport, and so it increases the cost of housing, and it makes it so complicated. So I hope that in your deliberations you contemplate some of those challenges that Richfield faces, and which are very unique for the location.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you for hearing our bill. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Chair will lay Senate File 1575 over for possible inclusion. Senator Osmick. Welcome, Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to present Senate File 1843. This is a TIF extension or TIF financing modification for the city of Wayzata. City of Wayzata is on the northeast corner of Lake Minnetonka. It has approximately a population of 4,200 people plus. It has a vibrant downtown. It has many city festivals, particularly the James J. Hill Festival, which is packed, and I also do the dunk tank at that festival. So if you are looking to get even with me, here's your opportunity in September to come and do the dunk tank. Parking is a challenge. Parking is a very big challenge for this particular city. The original TIF district that we are working to modify here was envisioned for parking and street improvements in the city of Wayzata, which have been very successful. It allows for $3 million capture in funds to fund an additional parking structure, which they are finding the need for because they have been so successful. This $3 million will be part of a greater project, which will actually be $9 million. So it is only a portion of that project that you would be allowing based on this legislation. I would note that Senator Skoy has been recently to the city of Wayzata for the crab cakes at Cove Restaurant, which is a great addition to the Wayzata landscape. So with that, I will defer to my two testifiers. To my right, Mayor Ken Wilcox of the city of Wayzata, and city manager on my left, Heidi Nelson of Wayzata.
Welcome, Mayor Wilcox.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senators, and thank you, Senator Osmick. We look at this as a continuation of what we had intended all along with this TIF district for a number of reasons. We made a lot of changes as were contemplated with the TIF district, but the parking ramp itself got delayed because of economic and political issues, and now the crunch is on us. We've got to get this done, and so we do want to continue what was contemplated with the original TIF district. And so we ask that the five-year rule be considered as met.
Thank you, Mayor Wilcox. And could you say your name for the record so we can put the voice with the name?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Ken Wilcox.
Thank you very much. City Manager, Ms. Nelson.
Chair, members of the committee, I don't know that there's much more to add. I think they've both represented the issue very well. Our ask is really just to consider the five-year rule met as we proceed with this parking project that allows us to capture the last 7 years of increment that are available in the district. So it's really just extending what the city had put in place in 1995. Happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. Do you have any backup or supporting information that you have supplied to our staff about this project rather than just the bill itself, Senator Osment?
Senator Osment.
And I would like to see it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I don't have any with me. This was actually put in very, very recently. However, I certainly can have them provide you that supporting documentation within the next few days.
Thank you. I'm very, I get very leery, Mr. Chairman, Senator Osment, and Mayor Wilcox. About just having legislation put in on, and appreciate the work of the legislators, but we need to know more about the project than just your testimony.
And just a couple. So
you can send the information to Mr. Sylvia.
And is this is not excess increment. This is increment that would be collected in the future, Ms. Nelson. And if you could say your name for the tape, please.
Sure. Chair, members of the committee, Heidi Nelson, city manager for the city of Wayzata. The district, when it was established in 1995, the max duration of that district would go through 2022. Without the special legislation to consider the five-year rule met for the parking project, the district would time out this year because the obligations that have been completed in the district would be the bond service, the debt service would be paid on those as of this year. So with the five-year rule being met, a new project is entered, and then it allows us to capture the last 7 years of increment that are available in the district as it was defined when it was created in 1995.
And Ms. Nelson, at the rate of collection, are you projecting it would take the 7 years to raise the $3.5 million?
Chair, members of the committee, yes. We're looking for that increment right around that $3 million. It pays about $360,000 a year, depending on where property tax values go. As Senator Osmick mentioned, the total project costs are estimated just around $9 million for the parking deck. And so this is a piece of the funding for that project. The city will be bringing other capital funds. We have some other TIF district resources that we'll be using, as well as the potential for some assessments for the project to get it completed.
Thank you very much. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1843? And we'll look for some background documentation from the city. Senator Osmick, anything else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will get you a definition of what currently has happened within that TIF district, as well as the anticipated extension
and
what will happen.
Mr. Chairman, et cetera.
Senator Rest, the estimates.
Yeah, all the information that justifies the extension and the assumption of the five-year rule, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Reiner.
I was just wondering if we could get the exact date on the dunk tank. I want to get that in my
Mr. Chair, Senator Reiner, that would be the first Sunday following Labor Day at approximately noon or 1 o'clock.
Perfect.
If you'd like to schedule it.
Thank you.
And we can only hope it's a cold fall day.
Thank you, Senator Scoia, anytime.
Chair, I'll lay Senate File 1843 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Osmond. Senator Rest, I think we should do your bill next.
Yep,
are you ready?
Ready.
Senate File 1893. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 993 represents the work done by the League of Minnesota Cities and the state auditor regarding reporting and accounting for generally administrative expenses within the within the tax increment financing statutes for which the cities are responsible. And the bill is mostly technical in nature as it addresses those issues that were identified by both the state auditor and the league. And we can, I'm going to have the league spokesperson go through the actual technical provisions if you have any questions. They were part of the discussion on it. And then actually I have two amendments to offer. One is a technical one, which I'll do now, if you will, and then one is more substantive policy, which I am offering to this bill. And the technical amendment is the A2, and I move the A2.
Senator Rest offers the A2 technical author's amendment. Any conversation, members? It's being handed out. It's a technical amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A2 is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, that technical amendment did have to do with interfund transfers that was an issue identified by the state auditor that needed further clarification. So a lot of language there, but it's also a technical issue.
And Senator Rush, should we pass out the other amendment now, or
Why don't we wait on that one to get through this other part of the bill? And Mr. Chairman, I can't find my glasses, so I have to use a magnifying glass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. As Senator Rest mentioned, this bill was the result of a very long process. For the past 2 years, the Development Finance Task Force at the League of Minnesota Cities has worked with the Office of the State Auditor and nonpartisan legislative staff in order to draft legislation that would clarify certain provisions of the TIF statute where there was confusion or disagreement about how the language should be interpreted. When we began this process, the bill was much longer, and we dealt with a number of other issues. If we were unable to reach consensus on how they should be addressed, we simply took those out of the bill, and we will maybe talk about those at another time. So the language in front of you does represent some consensus. The state auditor does not take a policy position on provisions such as this, but they participated throughout the process, and they are neutral on the bill provisions. This is supported by the League of Minnesota Cities, by Metro Cities, by the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, and we have not heard any opposition to the bill. I'll walk through the provisions of the bill, and as I go through, I'll just incorporate the changes that were made in the A2 amendment. On page 1, the language adds a new, expands the definition of administrative expenses to include usual and customary maintenance costs of a TIF district that would be owned by a taxing authority. This issue came about because there was a disagreement about what the current definition of administrative expenses included. Cities that owned properties felt it was necessary to do certain maintenance of them. It might mean plowing snow on a property that before it's been developed, and a housing, for instance, an HRA or a housing project, it might include maintenance of the building. Cities thought that was an administrative expense. The state auditor disagreed, and there was some back and forth about what the law actually meant. And so today we are here asking to clarify and say that maintenance is an administrative expense under the TIF Act. I should note that administrative expenses under the Act are capped at 10% of the estimated TIF expenditures for the whole project. So there is a natural existing cap on what type of how much an administrative expense can be charged for a project. That language, all of Section 1 are changes related to that. Sections 2 also put that definition into the definition of increment, which is necessary to achieve what I just described. Sections 3, 4, and 5 are purely technical amendments that the state auditor asked that we include in this bill. There's no substantive policy changes there. You can see they're simply adding reference to a subdivision that was omitted inadvertently in statute. and just aligning definitions so that they more clearly meet. Section 6 makes changes to the interfund loan resolution process in state statute. Interfund loans are authorized by the statute, and that would be a case where a taxing authority or city might make a payment for a allowable use of increment from the general fund of the city and then reimburse itself from the increment when that revenue comes through. In order to do that, cities pass interfund loan resolutions, which are approved by the city council. In many cases, that's a lengthy and onerous – it's not a lengthy process. It's a process where that requires city council action. It takes time, and there are many types of interfund loans that are more procedural and probably don't need to have full council approval. So what we've done here is create an alternative to the interfund loan resolution. A city can designate a financial officer or other appropriate officer of the city. When an interfund loan is made, they will make a writing that designates that the interfund loan was made. It will say what it was for. It will set the terms of it. That writing will be part of the annual TIF report that goes to the state auditor. So it reduces the administrative burden of having to have full city council approval for sort of routine interfund loans, but it maintains the transparency because the auditor will have all of the information as part of the annual TIF report. The language on page 7 also designates when an amendment to a interfund loan resolution or a writing can be made. And I'll draw your attention to line 7.3. That is one of the changes made in the A2 amendment. On 7.3, the A2 amendment deletes the phrase latest termination and inserts decertification. The decertification of a TIF district is a term of art. It is defined in statute. It is very clear when a district is decertified. Termination, while referenced in statute, is not defined, and so we thought it would be more clear to use decertification so there was an absolute deadline as to when an amendment could be made to a resolution. The language on 7.8 and 7.9 simply clarifies the existing practice that an interfund loan resolution can be formatted as a drawdown so that the resolution could state we authorize the interfund loan of up to X amount of dollars to be used for these certain allowable costs. That's simply so that a city doesn't have to pass multiple interfund loan resolutions monthly to deal with routine costs. And then the language on 714 to 718, paragraph F, that was deleted in its entirety and replaced with the language in the A2 amendment. The reason for the amendment is because the language as introduced did not accomplish what we had intended it to accomplish. This language lists three types of expenses that would be exempted from the interfund loan resolution process. Administrative expenses I would call pre-certification expenses. So before a district is even certified, a city or a taxing authority will have to spend money to get the district ready for certification. Those costs would not require an interfund loan resolution in order to be reimbursed. It does clarify that, again, all of those costs have to be submitted to the auditor for review in the TIF annual report. So we feel that it's again, reducing slightly the administrative burden, but maintaining the transparency that we think that the auditor needs and that we should have. And the last line I'll just mention on item 3, which is on line 7.17 of the bill, that deals with the situation where you may have a temporary negative fund balance for a TIF project. Perhaps you've made an interfund loan in November to cover a cost, knowing that the increment will come in February. Because it transfers over 2 years, you have a negative temporary balance, and I think most parties agree there wasn't a need to have an interfund loan resolution to cover that. So that would just clarify that you don't need that resolution. Again, you would have a writing. The writing would be submitted as part of the annual report. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Hines. Thank you, Senator Rest, for authoring this.
Questions, members? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, not a question, but perhaps technical drafting suggestion for Senator Vester, Mr. Hines, or Senate Council. The two languages at the bottom of page one and page two, where you're talking about using the TIF money for usual and customary maintenance costs. In the first page, it was kind of strange language, including without limitation amounts for ordinary and extraordinary repairs and maintenance. Then later on, it says an amount not greater than 10%. It wasn't clear if the 10% modified the entire paragraph. In the same similar language on the second page, you do it better. You say capital reserves in amount not greater than 10% and extraordinary and ordinary and extraordinary repairs. So I think the second page is a lot clearer language. Otherwise, it sounds like you're saying it's without limitation but not more than 10%. The second page is saying, no, it's just the capital expenses that are not more than 10%. So I think the second page is better language for clarification.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, both provisions are limited by 10%. And if you feel that's not, committee feels that's not clear with regard to the administrative expenses at the in Clause 6 on page 1, if you could develop some parallel language that would say that, you know, both of capital and maintenance expenses, ordinary, extraordinary, whatever, are limited by the 10% rule.
Senator Marty.
That's not what you meant.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm not sure which way what you're saying is intended is the opposite of what I'd read on page 2. And the first page was unclear. In other words, if you want the 10% cap to be for that entire clause, the first page might be that if you took out the without limitation language. The second page doesn't use that without limitation language because it's pretty clear on the second page that 10% limit is just for the capital reserves. So if you want it to be one or the other, in other words, I'd say the first page, if you took out that without limitation, it would work. The second page, it says the opposite of that, it seems to me.
Mr. Hine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. I think just to clarify, there are really talking about two different 10% caps. That when I referenced administrative costs, I referred to the 10% cap in existing statute. So all administrative costs are limited to 10% of the total project. The new language on the first page on line 1.23 refers to 10% of the market value of the property. That 10% cap is intended to restrict the amount of the capital reserves, not the entire administrative costs. And so if I just wanted to clarify that, since there's two different 10% caps in play, and we'd certainly be willing to, you know, make any changes so that's clear. But the intent is the capital reserve can be no more than 10% of the market value of the property, and existing TIF statute puts a 10% cap on all administrative costs for a project. And again, if the language on the second page does that better than the first, we'd be happy to make that change.
Mr. Chair, then Mr. Hines, given that, then I suggest you might strike the without limitation, page 1, line 22, because it's not without limitation if it's a 10% overall cap. But it just was unclear to me. You've explained what you intended, and I figure you and Senate Council can work it out. It was just unclear.
Senator Rest. Perhaps Mr. Hines and you will work with Mr. Sylvia and clarify that this is the most restrictive language that you would like.
We'll work with Mr. Sylvia on that.
Anything else, members? Senator Sanger.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Rest, I appreciate your work you've done on this. And then all that said, I, as a former city council person, I'm bothered by the delegation authority that albeit, well, city councils have, and I'm referring to line 625 through 627, where a city may delegate to their financial officer all this, the authority for reporting and so on and so forth. And most cities will probably do that by some resolution prepared by their staff and not probably even completely understood by their city council members. But every time we do this, I think we erode an educational opportunity for city council members. I just believe they need to have this in front of them. They need to have it explained to them routinely as these things occur. And and albeit efficiencies are fine, sometimes maybe efficiencies aren't so good. Maybe the educational process that city council members need to have in some of this complex TIF language is important. And they're going to miss that by the delegation, which they'll probably casually give. Mm-hmm. And then as these things come up time to time, they're going to simply not even know what happened. Their financial officer will have done it, and they will be completely in the dark about all of this. And it just tends to bother me a little bit, and I had to say it.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this is something provision suggested by the city, so I'm expecting that they're acting in their own best interests with regard to this provision. But I can understand Senator Senjum's concern, and maybe Mr. Hines can talk to us about the process that the league used in coming to this provision.
Mr. Chair, we don't need to dwell on it. I just had to vent a little bit because it does.
It's okay. No.
I think it is concerning, at least from the standpoint of, again, city council members showing up every couple of weeks, perhaps casually given their menu of things to approve, but they need to know about this stuff. This is important. They need to know and understand it because they're in charge.
Yeah. So, I sympathize with that. This would be an education opportunity for the members as they were required to go through and analyze these complicated TIF stuff. Senator Ortman.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Senjum. I think there may be too much delegation of authority here, but I'd like to know, are there limits for the uses of these interfund loans, and are there limits to the amounts of these interfund loans? That might make it a little easier for me to agree with delegating that authority if I knew that there were restrictions on how and how they could be used and how much can be transferred.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and members, the section of law that's being amended, 469-178, does lay out the allowable uses of an interfund loan. I'd have to double check to say if there's an actual cap on how much an interfund loan can be made for. In response to the concern, I would say that on the one hand, city council certainly doesn't have to delegate that authority. It can decide to retain the authority for itself. And secondly, on a lot of basic spending items that a city might do, most of those don't raise to the level of having a full city council approving them by resolution. There are many types of costs that are ongoing that the city council won't approve. It's similar to the city council doesn't approve payroll. City Council doesn't approve most of the expenditures, and I think this is similar to that. When the TIF district is created, there is a TIF plan that has to be approved by the City Council. There are a lot of steps that go through the public process to say, this is what the district will do, this is how long it will last, this is what the what's allowed to be spent. And so we would view this as more of an administrative streamlining that, again, still shows up as part of the annual TIF report, so that not only the state auditor but the city council and everyone else can see how that money was spent.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple more questions on this. Is the delegation of authority limited to that one TIF district? So every time there's another TIF district, that city council or the next city council will be asked whether they want to delegate that authority?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I believe that this would apply to each TIF district, that you wouldn't have an interfund loan resolution for every TIF district in a city, that it would be one. Now, no one had asked me that question before now. I think that's accurate, but if council disagrees, please correct me.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Orban and members, the way I read the language, it would be that for every particular transfer or fund. So I think it would be, it wouldn't be a blanket authority for all districts, but it would be for each individual transfer.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, so if I understand, then the City Council can make that designation for that one TIF district, being fully made aware of all the particulars of that TIF and how it's being operated, and then can make those delegations. And if they go forward with a second TIF district, they would have that opportunity again to review how those interfund transfers would be working and whether or not they want to delegate. Is that a good understanding?
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Orman, that's my understanding and my reading of the language.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Orman.
Yeah, I think that's a little easier for me, but I still want to know what the limitations are in the uses of those interfund transfers, especially when your amendment contemplates a transfer made in anticipation of a negative cash balance. That troubles me. If the TIF is going to go negative, but we've got an officer that is authorized to make that transaction, I think that's troubling. So I hope that you would consider taking out that they can't transfer in anticipation of a negative cash balance without going back to the City Council. I think the delegation should be much more restrictive than that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sylvia, can they do that now?
Mr.
In
Sylvia.
Terms of interfund transfers, this is language coming at the request from the amendment from the state auditor, not from the cities, but.
Mr. Sylvia.
Okay, I'm sorry. They're okay with it, but it's, you know, work. It's a joint work. However, the state auditor does not take positions on policy, so they're neutral, but they do help the cities along, let's put it that way.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rest. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanjum.
I don't mean to dwell on it. You know, from the standpoint of each individual TIF district, and I'm not sure, you know, across the state, they vary in time length. In Rochester, we've had them not infrequently for 20 years. So, you know, one console that starts all this, and then time goes, and that entire console is probably replaced in 20 years, has no idea about, unless they really check minutes and really get into you know, some interrogation, have no idea what other consuls have done, what the terms were, et cetera, et cetera. I just think the City Council has missed a great opportunity for education if we allow this.
Sure. Let's work with the
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Esther.
I don't think I can make a complete amendment now because it requires more language or more striking or whatever, but in spirit, I'm going to move to strike lines 625 through 627 and wherever else would need to be changed before this provision, these provisions, would be suggested for the omnibus tax bill. I don't know if it's too, Senator Ortman, Senator Senjum, Mr. Sylvia, I don't know, it's too complicated to do right now, but at least that part of it, I think you make a good case. And this is the delegation of authority to the city manager, the economic development director, or whoever, that it should be a decision made by the City Council.
And Senator Ress, as you know, these will be laid over for possible
yes.
inclusion.
So I'm just trying to reassure that that provision will be eliminated or modified and in response to the concerns that have been raised.
To ensure that we act upon this, Senator Ress moves that we delete lines 6.26 through 6.25 through 6.27.
And there's going to
wherever
be
else that language might occur, and we'll straighten up the language later on.
Is that agreeable to the
agreeable,
committee?
Senator Senjum, Senator Ortman?
Very much.
Thank you.
Can I add something? That's my motion.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think is your intention also to reinstate the stricken language on lines 624 and 625, or just to delete the new language?
Mr. Sylvia, you probably would have to reinstate it, or it would be uncertainty.
I think it needs to be reinstated.
I would add that.
And we would also, in the motion, reinstate the stricken language. Anything else? Seeing nothing, all those in favor say aye. The oral amendment.
Aye.
All those say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Senator S., do you have another amendment?
Yes, I do. And we will need some additional action on that paragraph B, but we can take that up later. It does get to be very complicated to do
Mr.
in committee.
Chair.
But Senator the intent Eaton. Is there.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on, I never did hear if the cities currently have the ability to transfer funds that they do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, they do have that authority.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Est.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, I have the A1 amendment. I'd like it treated as an author's amendment, but I will explain it.
Senator Rest moves the A1 author's amendment. Would you like us to adopt it before
yes,
you explain it?
Please.
It's being passed out. We will have a conversation. All those in favor
you.
Of the Senator Rest A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The A1's adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr.
You
Chairman.
What
this is a general law provision that that does not reflect the work of the cities and the state auditor, so I wanted to discuss separately. But it is a concern, represents a concern that has been raised in one specific tax increment project in Eagan that a lot of us, or some of us, have been thinking about a lot about whether it should become the challenge in that with regard to the participation of school districts in the process for acquiring an extension for a tax increment district, just what role should they play? And that rather than seeing that provision come up again and again with regard to tax special districts, which is what, if you look at the section of law 469-172 sub 2, deals with what happens when a tax increment district is desired to be extended, even though there is no but for within that discussion. You still need the approval of the entities that are levying their taxes for that. The school district in the Eagan project refused to give its approval. It was a very small part of Eagan, and it raised a general law question, at least for me. And so the A2 amendment states that school districts or that a city may move forward with an extension absent the approval of a school district, not just in Eagan, but anywhere else. And again, this is an extension, just like we just heard from Senator Osmet. I wanted 5 more years on the extension. What role should the other taxing entities play in that? And so the amendment eliminates the school district, but it eliminates the school districts on 2 accounts. Number one, their approval is not necessary. And number two, they're not going to be participated in levying taxes for the extension to pay for the extension of that tax increment district. So, and these are all done by special law when they have to come here and ask for them, the extension. So in paragraph C, if a special law, again, authorizes the extension and the city or town and county have approved it, as required under sub 2 and paragraph B there, tax increments for the purposes of the extension shall only be computed based on the levies for all taxing districts, but again, excluding the portion that's attributable to the school district levy because they will be excused from it. So They would no longer have veto power over extensions, but they also would not be obligated to fund it either. So it seems like to me that's a a good move going forward, and I think would should give us pause anyway when we are considering what is being proposed with extensions, and perhaps we need a lot more information about them as we move forward. But if a school district, I mean, the cities don't want their project, their extensions given by a special law to be vetoed, but it seems like to me if that is the case, then grant that. But also the intent here is that they not be included in the levying of the taxes. So that is the explanation of the amendment, and there is a retroactive effective date because it would also affect it's allowed to affect the Egan project that was approved by the legislature last year. So that's why the May 15th, that's probably the date we pass the tax bill or something.
Thank you, Senator Rustin. Members, there's a fair amount going on with this conversation that we're about to undertake. And we had a number of communities come before the committee this morning asking for these extensions. And for whatever reason, when the city was setting up their TIF district, they erred in their analysis as to how much increment they were going to get. And so they're here in front of us asking for these extensions. And the extensions, as Senator Rest pointed out, currently are assessed against the school district and the county. And, you know, so now the proposal on the A1 amendment that we adopted would relieve the school districts of the obligation to be participants in that extension. And my speculation would be that the counties would be requesting for the same treatment because they weren't involved in the establishment and the planning that was going on. And so when I look at this general law change that we're proposing, I think that we ought to contemplate including the counties in this proposal. And it would perhaps make the cities, when they're coming with their original TIF proposal, pay a little closer attention to what the potential increment is actually going to be. And so that the extensions would be, there would be more significant changes to the extension than there would have been to the original district.
And Mr. Chairman, there may well be a circumstance where a school district believes that the project is to its benefit and wants to participate. And I don't believe the language here precludes them from doing that. It just doesn't require them to. So it lets them they don't have veto power, so they can't stop it, but they also are not required to participate if they have not approved it.
And Senator Rest, as Mr. Sylvia pointed out to me, we could always do a notwithstanding.
Yes, indeed. So I do hope members will think about this. If there are people that want to explore the idea right now, that's fine with testimony. But I do think this is a way of dealing with this that speaks to all of these requests for extensions, which is why I was really asking City of Wayzata to give us some information, not just some language in a bill, about what actually is going to happen here and to show us the numbers. I wouldn't, you know, we should be asking for the financials from these cities to make the case for the extension and why they couldn't get it done, why they couldn't meet the 5-year rule, but to show us that they couldn't do it, not just to speak to it, if you will.
And Senator S., one of the communities that was here, I mean, they missed by over a third. I mean, it wasn't like it was close. It was not in the ballpark.
And Mr. Chairman, we've had extensions, and I've carried bills to, and maybe many of you, because we had such a rough time, 2005 to 2009 with the recession, where people, where cities were stymied and stalled and shut down with advancing their projects, and so extensions were made and exemptions from certain rules in the TIF law were given, but we're getting beyond that now, it seems to me, and we need to really consider what the general provisions of the TIF law mean, period. And maybe the city should bear it all when they ask for an extension and have that in their calculations for how long the extension should be. And I really, really want to have that discussion and hope that and maybe this is the wrong approach. But right now, a project is being held up because of a school district veto, which is their right according to the law. So I think there's a better way than just going along and saying, well, in this instance the county doesn't, and in this instance the city doesn't have veto, that comes forward because the cities have not been able to convince the county or the school district in this instance in Eagan of the value of continuing to participate in that project. And as I understand it with Eagan, it's just a narrow slip that's in Eagan of this school district. So it's, you know, they're looking at their bottom line too of what they're being asked to contribute, and they said no.
And the project is in that area, so they would receive the benefits from it, but they still said no.
Yes.
And Senator Rest, what would you think if I was to offer an oral amendment on page 1, line 24 of the A1 amendment, between district and levy, insert and counties, and chain levy to plural?
That's going farther than than where I am right now, but it certainly should be part of the discussion, and I don't think Mr. Hines saw the amendment with regard to Eagan before, but in the terms of this general law change, but maybe, and so I don't want to ask them to testify on the fly with regard to it, but I would like at some point to bring this issue back before the committee about just a general discussion of what's the proper general law for extension of TIF districts, because that is what we are seeing over and over again, and I think we need to have something that's more than just a case-by-case basis. So.
And Senator Rest, this is going to be laid over, so we will have an opportunity to have further conversation. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest. I understand what you're trying to do. It's good to kind of know what the general rules are. Right. But I also think we know that we sometimes have to make exceptions in certain unusual circumstances, and that's why folks come to the legislature. If we could just have a general rule that one size fits all, they wouldn't need to come. But they come because each situation is a little bit different. So I agree with the idea we're setting some general rules, but I think it is incumbent upon us to find those particular exceptions that really are important and where we should waive those rules.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, and I agree with you, and I am all too familiar with language that in TIF, special law TIF bills that comes in and says, this particular project is not subject to the following dozen provisions of the TIF law. Okay,
I've seen
lived
them.
With that yeah. for 30 years. But I would rather have them make the justification to say, notwithstanding this provision as changed, the school district must have, either must participate or it must have veto power, and have them truly make the argument for that in terms of the general law, and maybe counties too. But there is no participation in the but-for process with an extension. They don't have to go to them and have findings by these other entities. They just ask them to approve it. And maybe we should just make that a little bit more substantial. And actually, the Eakin project, which we worked on a lot last year with the city and its advisors to come up with a workable solution for them, that was actually the first instance in which school board said no. So that is not going to be a single instance, I think, in the future, because school districts are going to look at this and say, well, Egan said no, so how about Robbinsdale saying no, or how about Chaska School District saying, or no, it's South Carver County or something.
We all get along in Carver.
Yeah, there
County.
You go, right? Anyway, you understand what I mean, that a school
Senator
district
Marty.
Doesn't want to participate.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I appreciate the direction this conversation's gone, and I like Senator Rest's amendment, and I think Senator Scoy's addition would be a good one. And Senator Ortman, I agree with you. It's not one size fits all, but I think that's why both the chair and Senator Rest both mentioned the notwithstanding. They can come in here and make the case saying notwithstanding these two provisions, but I like the direction you're headed with this.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any way of knowing in the past how many cities maybe attempted to come forward, but the counties or school districts said no? No. Okay.
See lots of head shaking.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we'd have that information.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dietzick, I don't know, and perhaps because of that, they wouldn't have asked for a special district, but as I understand it, even though there was anticipation that the school district was going to say no, the special law was granted before that happened.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 993 as amended? And members, my expectation is that Senator Marty's going to offer an amendment to this when we see this.
Not today.
Seeing nothing else, thank you, Senator Rest. Chair will lay Senate File 993 as amended over for possible inclusion. Is he? Senator Champion. Welcome, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for the opportunity to come before you this morning to talk about Senate File 403. This is a bill regarding Emerge, which is a great organization in my district, and Emerge is based, as I sort of alluded to, in North Minneapolis, even though you know, as the senator for Senate District 59, that encompasses all of North Minneapolis, the North Loop, Downtown East, and Bryn Mawr. But this particular initiative is based in North Minneapolis, but it's focused on helping members of the entire community and even those who come from outside of North Minneapolis to find training and employment. Several years ago, Emerge undertook an ambitious plan to renovate Minnesota's oldest standing library building, which is on the National Register of Historic Places for Social and Architectural Significance. And the purpose for the renovation was to create additional training and community space. And so fundraising to undertake this renovation project included securing state historic preservation tax credits. And the bill before you today addresses an issue of conflicting requirements between our state historic tax credits and another source of funding for this project, a federal economic development grant. So with me today, Mr. Chair, is Mike Nguyen, who is the president of Emerge, to describe the project and the bill. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we could hear some testimony from President Mike Nguyen.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Mr. Nguyen.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Nguyen, president of Emerge, an organization based in North Minneapolis, as Senator Champion has described. We create economic opportunities through job training as well as revitalizing the built environment in our neighborhoods to seed greater economic investment. And we've been hard at work for the past 7 years on this important redevelopment of the historic North Branch Library. And we have been completing this renovation that has statewide significance. We've been working to renew and repurpose this building as the Emerge Career and Technology Center. And what the new center will enable us to do is expand job training opportunities, partnerships, employment opportunities, provide access to digital literacy as well, and opportunities for adults and youth in the community, and as well as successfully work with people with some of the highest barriers to employment in neighborhoods that have unemployment, some of the state's highest unemployment rates. It's a $6.5 million project. We've worked very hard to raise these funds through a wide variety of public and private partners, and our construction is just about finished. Is exactly the kind of project that the state historic tax credit was intended to help. And in fact, the first press conference for a job impact report was held at the building. And so we're here because, unfortunately, we're caught in a catch-22 situation. We've not been able to reconcile the state and federal requirements, as Senator describes. The state tax credit requires projects to be eligible for the federal rehabilitation tax credit, which means it must be owned by a for-profit taxpaying entity. And the federal EDA, Economic Development Administration, requirement, which is our largest funder, insists that the direct grantees must be nonprofits. So in spite of substantial legal research and negotiation with EDA, proving that the proposed for-profit would not benefit any for-profit entity, EDA still refused to allow the creation of this entity for the purposes of the project. So to remedy the issue, our request is to allow Emerge to receive a tax credit of $880,098, which would equal the amount the project would have received had it fully qualified for the state's historic rehabilitation tax credit. Without the tax credit, Emerge will be required to use program funds essentially to pay off the loans borrowed for bridge funding to fund the gap. This capital cost will impinge on our ability to deliver job training programs and reduces the number of people we can serve and will serve over the next 20 years. What we have planned for the center is very exciting and very important. Already over 75 construction jobs have been created, and we, in fact, through partnership with Minneapolis Building Trades Council and our contractors, we expect to serve more than 3,000 people annually who seek work and to improve their skills. 350 people will be engaged in career training tracks, including manufacturing, technology, med tech, administrative support, IT, and maintenance careers. We expect to help over 800 hard-to-employ citizens to gain full-time jobs each year.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen, and thank you, Senator Champion. I'm aware of the issues with regard to ownership and the tax credit. little hesitant to do an exemption, but I really look forward to working with both of you and the committee here to find a solution, because we'd like to figure this out so the original intent of the tax credit can be met. I do have one question. You said that the original credit was $880,000. Is that what the need is, too? I mean, what is the shortfall from the project?
Mr. Chair, the shortfall is $900,000. Oh, so it's more so than it that. is right there.
Okay. Questions, members? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, not a question, but just a comment. I was impressed by the stuff. This was the first, the oldest freestanding, oldest standing library still in the U.S., 1894, and first open shelf branch library. This truly is historic property that you've got in a beautiful place. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, one small correction, not the oldest in the U.S., but oldest in Minnesota.
Oh.
Oldest standing library in Minnesota. And it is believed to have been the first library where the open shelf, the open stack system was innovated right here in our state.
Thank you. Senator Reiner.
And thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to support your comments. When I first took a look at this, I thought, you know, why are we narrowing it down to this one little project? And I understood what the needs were, but representing Duluth, you know, we have a lot of history that we're trying to work on as well. So I've been a longtime supporter of our state tax credit. So it makes me a little nervous to sort of dive into that, but I do want to see us work with your project. So, Mr. Chair, just encourage your comments.
And Senator Reinhart, we're going to try to get creative and find a different way to get the goal accomplished, because I'm hesitant to give that exemption. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 585? Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. And just briefly,
Mr.
wanted to
Kelleher.
Go on record to express our concern about this approach. I know that you just said that you're going to work to figure out a way to help this project out. And I also want to go on record to say that this is a great historic preservation project, a great community development project. These historic preservation projects typically have multiple funding sources that sometimes collide with one another, and this is a case where this has happened. But we also don't want to see you carve out a state-only program, because the program was designed to have parallel between the federal program and the state program, which offers some checks and balances and accountability between the two.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Anything else, members? Seeing nothing, no further testimony. Chair LA Senate File number 403 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Champion. We'll continue to work and see what we can figure out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
Senator Stump. Senator Stump.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. The chair is nice and warm. I'm not sure what that means. If it's a hot seat or if it's... Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 668 is a bill relating to TIF for Thief River Falls, and it's for trying to address the housing, workforce housing needs in that community. There's been a lot of discussion about how to address that, and I know there's a lot of different bills and a lot of different approaches. But this is one that this committee heard, I believe, last year, and also the need has been addressed, and I believe there was a handout that came from Thief River Falls. Yes, that particular handout. The issue is good for the community, but for a smaller community, it's tough for them to figure out solutions, especially to large problems such as housing needs, and infrastructure needs. Those are two very expensive items. I believe in the testimony that was heard in, I believe it was state and local government, or Senator Tomasoni's committee on workforce housing, the one of the companies in Thief River Falls area, DigiKey, buses people in from, I believe, up to about 60-some miles every day. So they have almost a transit network set up to try to bring employees in. A lot of that is related to the fact that there just isn't any place for people to buy houses in the Thief River Falls area. This particular piece of legislation is one of the small tools that the community has asked for. Mr. Chairman, I do. There is an amendment, an A1 amendment that I would like to have the committee consider. And this was an amendment that came up in the.
Senator Stump, we'll pass the A1 out.
Okay.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and members, this allows new modular and new manufactured homes to be considered as part of the housing solution in Thief River Falls. What the city has done is the city has actually purchased a block of land, or it will be. I don't know if it's all in one contiguous block, but it's relatively all in one area on the western side of the city. And they have designated part of that land for different types of housing, such as modular and manufactured homes. And so that would be to kind of complement the other types of housing that they are working on.
Thank you, Senator Stump. Members, we're. Would somebody want to move the A1? Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. Members, what Senator Stump is talking about here is. And we have this issue in front of us with regard to sales tax on these units. These are units that are built inside a facility and then transported to the site. And we had this conversation in Senator Tomasoni's division, and I think Senator Stump thought it was a good conversation. Perhaps we should contemplate this as an option for part of the workforce housing in the proposal that you have in front of us today. So I don't know what your thoughts are. I tend to be supportive of his initiative here. Any conversation, members?
The manufactured homes,
yeah, on the A1 amendment. Yeah. Seeing none, let's all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to turn it over to Patrick for a further explanation.
Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to thank Senator Stump for authoring this bill again. He has worked very hard on the workforce housing issue the past two sessions. I'd like to also thank Senator Reinert, who has authored additional bills that would help address the workforce housing crisis in greater Minnesota. Last session, we had a workforce housing TIF bill in front of the Tax Committee. And the Tax Committee, instead of adopting a TIF provision, did put $2 million of general fund money into a pilot program in the omnibus tax bill. That money went to DEED for workforce housing projects located in three cities in Roseau and Pennington counties. The first city to use that money was the city of Roseau, and it received $325,000 from DEED to help finance a 30-unit apartment complex in the city. That project broke ground in September, and it's almost complete as we speak today. So I want to thank the Tax Committee for really stepping up and putting some money on the table to see how we could solve this problem. I think the Rosso project is very illustrative of what the problem is. That 30-unit complex cost $3.2 million to construct, and the appraised value of that project is $2.2 million. So you can see immediately how difficult it is to finance a project that's $1 million underwater before you've even put a shovel in the dirt. And that's a problem we're seeing in many communities in greater Minnesota. It's caused largely by the fact that the rental market rental rates are very low in the communities, and there hasn't been any market rate housing built in the past decade or even more in some places. So when you appraise a project, there are no comparables to look at. So the appraiser looks to the rental values. In Rosso, the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is approximately $550. In order to cash flow the project, the Parkland Place project, they would have to charge about $1,000 or $1,100 for a one-bedroom unit, which you simply can't do. You can't have that large of a spread between the market rent and the necessary rent. Also, because the appraisal is so low, a bank is limited to lending up to 80% of the appraised value. So for a $3.2 million project, the maximum amount that a bank can lend in this situation is $1.7 million. So the problem really is one of financing. There's great demand for housing. The city of Rosso has nearly a 0% vacancy rate. The Polaris is the primary employer. They testified earlier this session that they needed to hire 300 employees at the Polaris plant. Their starting wage, hourly wage, is higher than the average median wage, hourly wage in that area of Minnesota. So there's demand for this housing. It's not getting built because of the financing problems. And so we've proposed a number of solutions, one of which is a grant program modeled after the pilot program that this tax committee passed last year. And the other, again, is the workforce housing TIF. That's the bill in front of us now. This is a pared-down version from the one we brought last year. The bill last year contained two options. One was a 9-year economic development district for workforce housing. The other was a 25-year district modeled after the affordable housing TIF in existing law. We've eliminated the 25-year proposal from our bill. We understand there is a lot of concern from legislators about tying up increment for market rate housing for that long of a period of time. So the bill before you would expand the allowable use of an economic development TIF district to include workforce housing. That's a 9-year duration district. The language on page 3 is designed to limit the applicability to communities like Rosso or Worthington or Perham that have very low vacancy rates, have high demand for employers for new jobs, but simply can't get the housing financed. So if you use the Rosso project as an example, we view the TIF as one part of a way that a city can help to finance a project. In order to get this project financed, Rosso put a $460,000 deferred loan on the project. So it is loaning the developer $460,000, 0% deferred payment for 30 years. It also has a second mortgage on the property for an additional loan of approximately $150,000. And for the developer to secure all the necessary financing, there is another second mortgage from a bank that is collateralized by a separate property owned by the developer. So it's very complicated to get these projects funded, even with state money available. And so we view the TIF option as giving another tool for cities to use in order to finance these projects. And I would point out that in 2009 or 10, when the legislature passed the jobs bill, you temporarily expanded the allowable use for TIF, and that was done in response to the recession in order to get money into the economy. And the city of Perham used that expanded authority to develop workforce housing in its community. It's in the process of having 48 additional units built using an economic development TIF district for a 9-year duration. I think it's worked well there. I understand there are some concerns about what happens when you bring new residents to a community and have their property taxes go towards development as opposed to the services. I think the city of Rosso and the city of Perham have both said they think that the bigger problem is the long-term economics of their community and whether or not they're going to be able to get people there so that they can grow over the long term. I think with the shorter duration, we're talking about fixed costs when new residents come in. So 30 units in Rosso, you're not likely going to need to hire a new police officer or expand the hours of the library to accommodate that. So we do think cities are able to accommodate, you know, modest growth like that. And I'd point out that Senator Stumpf mentioned in Thief River Falls you have businesses busing in people. So you're bringing people into the community to work. None of those people are paying property taxes to Thief River Falls. And so we think if you get the housing built, it would be much better for Thief River Falls to have those workers paying local taxes there than paying taxes in Grand Forks and being bused in. And I'm happy to talk about the language in more detail and answer any questions. I appreciate the time.
And Mr. Hines, do you know which communities would qualify under these criteria? Or can you get us a list of who might qualify or what areas you're targeting?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, and members, the cities we have spoken to, we have a number of housing studies that cities have performed that have vacancy rates in this area. Worthington is one, Perham, Thief River Falls, Rosso, Jackson, I believe Laverne is another. So we can get a list. It's hard to be absolute because it would depend on cities getting a housing study. I know Duluth, for instance, also is struggling similarly with low vacancy rate and high demand for housing. I think they would qualify as well.
Spread pretty broadly on the western part of the state anyway.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's true, although the case of Duluth is certainly one where they have extremely low vacancy rates, and we had testimony in a different committee from Cirrus, the airplane manufacturer, that is desperately trying to hire more workers in Duluth, and many of them are simply turning down job offers because they can't find a place to live in the city.
And so of the gap that is occurring in your based on your testimony, do you have an idea how much of the gap this will cover?
Mr. Chair and members, on the Rosso project, which was a $3.2 million construction cost, I think the estimate was in the range of $250,000 to $300,000. So it's certainly not the silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems. What we see time and again with our cities is that they are cobbling together these projects any way they can, and they're being creative with financing. In Rosso, we had, that second loan from a bank using collateral on a different property. They're doing what they can to get it done. So we view the TIF as yet another option so that when developers sit down with cities, they have a whole range of options to go through, and hopefully they can get something together.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hines and Senator Stump, I like this project, this proposal, a whole lot better than I liked the one last year. And one of the reasons is that because of the grant program, we now are starting a history of success. And that was not clear, for one thing, last year. And I certainly like the idea that it's not going to be a 25-year district, absent requests for extensions. Okay. But I have a couple of questions. You're still looking at the grant program to continue. Is that so? You're asking for dollars for that, for the grant program, in addition to this modified TIF law. New law.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, yes, we are asking for the grant program to be expanded statewide. Senator Stumpf has legislation that would appropriate $5 million in fiscal 16 and $5 million in 17 to deed to expand the pilot program statewide to the qualifying cities.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, is that program administered through deed or through the Housing Finance Agency?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, it's administered through deed.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines, or Senator Stumpf, the addition of this manufactured homes amendment that we just put on, how does that work within the TIF program that you envision? Is it less of an expense to do that, and does cash flow work if you did TIF for manufactured housing under workforce housing or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I believe the testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The testimony in Senator Tomasoni's committee was that it was, and I believe Chairman, you were there too. Was about, was it $80 per square foot compared to, I believe it was well over 150 for the other. So it was a much more reduced rate in terms of the cost, and that the city's intent is that these homes would be permanent, you know, that they would be on permanent foundations. I may be missing something. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that you were there for the testimony as well. But I think it was to treat these that option as if it was permanent housing.
It's interesting.
Mr. Chairman, I really taken with the point made of having people come in from other areas that are bused in or vanned in or whatever to come to their jobs, and there was an article in the Sunday newspaper about the situation in Worthington. Now, these were not these were people with jobs. They weren't poor people, but they also weren't $50,000 a year jobs. But they were living in Iowa and the Dakotas, and that was highly offensive. That they couldn't find a place in Minnesota. And I realize Worthington is in the corner there, but I think that is a striking example of why we need to do something. And maybe this should be a tool in the toolbox. I hope we can work. I hope we can work something out, Mr. Chairman. But I am really taken with the modesty, quite frankly, of the proposal, rather than trying to get creating a new use for an economic development district, which, as opposed to putting in a lot of notwithstandings, conditions of blight and this and that and the other thing that you would have needed for a 25-year district, which just is a non-starter for me. I think that is that's more appealing to me personally. So that's what I think.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to what the average wage is from these. I guess there's one or two manufacturers in each city.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Eaton, it does vary quite a bit. For like Arctic Cat and Thief River Falls, I believe their starting salary is right around $13 an hour. DigiKey is about the same. They have, like at Arctic Cat, and the same way with Polaris Industries, there, if you are a welder, you're probably starting at maybe $15 to $16 an hour. And if you're, assembler on the the equipment, it's probably more like that $13 to $14. Again, it depends on how long you've been there. They have profit sharing, and so that works as if a portion of your salary is matched with by the company, and then at the end of the year you get a kind of a bonus.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Well, I was going to suggest that we let supply and demand work a little better here in the market, but it appears the problem is the wages. So perhaps the industries would like to step up and pay their workers.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Eaton, I'm going to build on that a little bit. Mr. Hines mentioned we had lots of conversations on this last year, and I did have a bill in this year, but I thought it would just be more convenient to sort of work off Senator Stump's bill. But if you took, I just self-numbered these, page 7 of the Thief River Falls handout, and with some minor modification, you have Duluth. Housing stock is old and rents are low. Current rents do not support investment. Risk-reward has not yet enticed developers. Good wages are paid, but they do not yet support higher rents. Lack of contractors has driven up costs significantly. And in our case, and I don't think it's quite the same in Senator Stump, your situation, lack of construction-ready building sites has driven up costs significantly. You know, in our case, we have a city that's now over 150 years old. It's completely built out. We always say in Duluth, if it's not been built on, there's a reason why. And it usually has to do with some steep topography, rock, clay subsoil, or we need to take something down and clean that site up. And that is a significant contributor. So, Senator Eaton, I sort of approached this with your same perspective. I thought, why are we getting in an area that the private market ought to be doing? And what I've come to learn is that we need to do a little catch-up in some of our communities where the market just has not yet brought the resources to bear. And so along with Senator Rest, I had some similar concerns about these long time periods, because that replaces the market versus a shorter, more prescribed time period that I think incents the market or encourages it, which I think, Senator Stump, your bill now really does. One different aspect I think that we have in Duluth is that it really isn't just limited to rental. You mentioned Mr. Hines, Cirrus. Those are professional positions. In addition, we have Bar Engineering, LHB Engineering, Essentia Healthcare, St. Luke's Hospital. They're all saying the same thing, and they're really talking about professional level positions. And so we have, in addition to Senator Stump, what you've brought forward, a market rate home challenge, but all the same factors come to bear. And so, you know, as we move forward on this, I would ask Senator Rest and Senator Skoy, Senator Stump, that we really look at on page 3, on lines 3.32 and 3.34, just taking out rental and talking about housing. And I think that, you know, this now is a bill that applies across the entire state, and I think that gives, it's still narrowly prescribed in time frame, it's still narrowly prescribed in terms of the unemployment and the employer verification that there's a genuine need here, but it doesn't limit to just rental, because just frankly for my community that would be too narrowly drawn. We have a mix of this challenge, so that would be my request as we move forward. Thank you.
Senator Stump, Mr. Hines, do you have any thoughts on that change, proposed change?
Mr. Chair and members, we would not oppose that change. I think, as Senator Reinert mentioned, one of the challenges is some of the problems can vary community by community. And so while ROSO and Duluth are both facing market rate workforce housing challenges, the cause of the challenge can vary a bit, and also the need can vary a bit. And so, you know, putting these bills together, we're constantly trying to find that balance between not simply opening up the floodgates and allowing subsidized housing for, you know, any house in any community, but we're also cognizant that, you know, as you narrow it, certain cities with severe problems might get excluded. So I think what Senator Reinert said makes a lot of sense in this context, and we'd support that change if the committee wanted to do it.
And members, what Mr. Hines said, I think, was important to think about. We don't want to continue to subsidize housing everywhere for everything, but I think what would be nice if we could accomplish is that we would demonstrate success with these projects so that the gap would narrow, because people would recognize that they're, if they do find, you know, put money in to invest in these type of projects, that they can cash flow. And so hopefully that would be one of the goals that we can accomplish with this. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this bill very much, Senator Stumpf. It seems to me that new problems need new solutions, and this is one of those new solutions for a problem that we've not really had before. The private market did previously solve some of these problems, and it's not. And I really appreciate what the city of Roseau did to be creative and invest in this proposal. That's the point I want to make, though, is that I'm sure that the city of Roseau did its due diligence. They made sure that the projects were quality projects. And that's my biggest concern, is to make sure that we maintain a very high standard of quality for this housing, that we're not just building housing to build housing quickly and get it accomplished, but that there really is very good quality that meet very high expectations, especially if state money is being used to facilitate a private developer's construction. So whatever protections you can put in place to maintain that high level of quality housing, I think it's worth every effort you can make to do that, because the last thing anybody wants is to have substandard housing developed and then have the tragedy later. So I appreciate the tool here, but as soon as you introduce manufactured homes, and I know they can be very good quality, I just ask you to please make sure that you've put provisions in this bill to maintain very high standards of quality construction, long-term nature of the projects.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I like the discussion we're having right now. I think it's a healthy one. I think Senator Stumpf's bill does address a huge problem, and it is statewide, and it's not just rental, and as Senator Ortman said, we want to have quality housing and so on. I think the thing that's, I guess it's almost a rhetorical question, but this huge gap between you spend $3 million to build a housing project and it's worth $2 million a day you finish. It's a problem that I guess the almost rhetorical question is, why doesn't the invisible hand of the market work? Why isn't supply and demand working? Why isn't private market doing this? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think it partly says that that's why the unregulated market doesn't work. But I think that this is a huge issue. I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, that's why it's so frustrating, because I think this bill may be a good step forward, but I think we've got it's a bigger gap than we seem to acknowledge. I mean, we'll take care of this problem in Thief River Falls or Worthington or Duluth. But bottom line is, I think it's happening everywhere. And I'm glad you're trying to address it here. And I like what you're trying to do. I just think we've got some big underlying questions we don't address. And that is why that the market that's supposed to take care of these doesn't work that way.
And Senator Marty, I think that's hence the multiple approaches that are right. Moving forward. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this discussion about market rate and workforce housing is important, and it is important statewide. And we've talked about the different variables, but there's one side that I haven't heard mentioned in this discussion yet today, and that is the cost of building in Minnesota. Senator Stumpf is a co-sponsor on Senate File 1267, Senator Eakin's bill, which we just heard in the Jobs, Ag, and Rural Development Committee last week. And interestingly enough, the bill actually is just to exempt border cities from state building code changes that Minnesota has undertaken that are more stringent than the border cities across the state line. And the testifier said that the just the energy code and the international building code that this state has adopted, that our neighboring states has not, has increased the cost of 1- and 2-bedroom homes by $25,000. So the one thing that we do need to look at is the building code things that we have adopted for this state and how that's impacting the price. And that is a statewide issue as well. So I think that's an important part of the conversation that we're not having today that we should have.
Thank you. Senator Rest.
Thank you. Well, just to respond a little bit to, first of all, to Senator Nelson, I do think that within these TIF districts, relative to what Senator Ortman said to Senator Stumpf about manufactured housing and so forth, that we do need to make sure that this is going to be quality housing and that it meets some standards. And maybe the border cities have a special case to make, but I would not like to see this housing not meet standards that either put the renters at risk, or if we do extend it to homes, put the homeowners at risk. But again, that is a discussion for another time. I'm not comfortable at this point with extending this to single family homes not even multifamily single family homes. And what I look back to is the housing districts that were set up to start with, that are the long districts, they were looking at providing what we would now call workforce housing. It was not being used to fund luxury apartments in downtown Minneapolis. That was not the point. But we did have a separate set of criteria for scattered site housing, which was applicable to single family homes. And those were usually homes that were in such disrepair or so old that it didn't make any sense to rehab them. It only made sense to tear them down and build affordable homes in their place, ones that matched the community, not a McMansion inside of a community that was still cottage-type homes from World War II that didn't have basements. But we have a separate set of criteria for scattered site housing and the conditions under which it can be used, and for TIF that can be used for apartment buildings. And I think that if we're going to move forward with a workforce housing, and it gets beyond workforce housing, it seems to me. I mean, what level of housing are we talking about here? Homes that we should look for a different set of criteria, just as we did in differentiating between housing districts, which was apartment housing, and scattered site housing, which could be used for single-family homes. So just to add homes, single-family homes, into the language here makes me uncomfortable without a separate set of criteria. And maybe that can be developed. I'm not saying it's off the table, but not just lumping it in. That would I be very uncomfortable with. And in addition, we have the grant program last year. Looks like it's a go. It's going to be the project in Roseau is almost finished. It's going to be inhabited. I would assume they have a waiting list to get in those apartments. If we move forward with this now, with regard to the economic, what essentially is an economic development district for workforce housing, seems like to me that we can get a little bit of history here on how it works, and or make sure that the criteria we use, just like we didn't put scattered site housing and say, oh, this is a housing district. We didn't do that. We recognized that it was a totally different animal, and it seems like to me that we should be cautious in assuming that the rental units and the homes are the same thing. They're not. In my opinion, they're not. So I would not support just adding them, Senator Reinert, but maybe they're part of a progression of how we can use this tool to address the concerns both in the rental market and in the owner market, but not – this is a big step if we do this, a huge step to allow this for market-valued housing, keeping in mind always going back to what was the purpose of tax increment financing to start with, and it was to build where others would not build. Mm-hmm. It was to save the inner cities. It was to save the regional centers that were in Minnesota that were over 100 years old, that had dilapidated housing, dilapidated manufacturing, that their main street was just wiped out. That's what it was for. And this is a different... You know, this is really a fork in the road to go this way. And taking it a step at a time, I think, gets you more support than a revolution.
Members, we have one more testifier and one more bill and five more minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be short. I just want to say thank you to Senator Stump for bringing this forward. I know it's been a thoughtful two-year discussion. I've had numerous discussions with developers and housing advocates in my neighborhood on some of the challenges we have in the urban core, and I've explained how they might be a little different, but it is just lack of housing options, whether it be in the urban core, in Duluth, or in Thief River Falls. And so thank you. I think this helps move the discussion along. Regarding the manufactured homes, we had that discussion in Thomasoni's Environment and Economic Development Finance, and I was exactly where Senator Ortman was and some others on questioning, do we really want to put, you know, state money into what could be, you know, junk. We've had some manufactured homes in North Minneapolis that probably 10 years ago that were not well. They were not good, and they created all sorts of problems. But as the discussion evolved in this conversation, I think several of us at first were very skeptical of putting, you know, is this where we want state money to go? But I, for one, after the conversation, was comfortable with it. I think they do need to be quality, and I do need to think that we need to make sure they're quality. And they're, I can give you the manufacturer that dropped them off in North Minneapolis. I would not use them. But I think we were comfortable at the way the conversation went, and that there would be a good checks and balances to make sure that this addressed the problem, but we didn't have to then go back and clean it up in 10 years. So,
Ms. Cadu.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Gadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here in support of Senator Stump's bill, and I'd like to thank the work of the League of Minnesota Cities. They've done a great job going around the state talking about this issue. We've been hearing this concern regarding in many of the communities around the state from our businesses. This is a good problem in the sense that our employers in greater Minnesota want to grow and expand in their communities. Unfortunately, the market is not currently working with the ability to finance these projects for market-rate housing. And it's also a good sense in that you can see there's a good paying jobs because employees are willing to right now commute up to 60 miles or more an hour to get to these jobs. But it'd be much better if we could have affordable housing or workforce housing in these areas. We think you need multiple tools. I think TIF would be one of these tools with this limited duration. We also hope some of these bills on the grant dollars can also move forward this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Senator Reinert, briefly, and then Senator Senger. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest. I would be eager to work with you on that because one of my concerns is that we need to be thoughtful about incenting new and not being thoughtful about what happens in our existing stock in our existing neighborhoods.
Senator Senger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to defend this idea of manufacturing homes a little bit. In the late 90s, early 2000s, our community faced, as we always continue almost, through this affordable housing crisis. But one of the projects that we did, I was on the city council, I think it's about 80 to 100 units, is manufactured homes. And they're put together in a very, very nice development. There certainly are rules. I drove through there last fall. It looked wonderful. We wouldn't even consider it workforce housing. We would just consider it a nice housing development. And so these things can work. And, you know, if we ever get down to Rochester, I'd love to show you all.
Thanks, Senator St. Jim. And Mr. or Senator Stump and Mr. Hines, I had one question I think we'll work on as we go along. It's in Section 4 where you have the income limits for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Challenge Grant, contemplating whether, rather than income limits, maybe we could limit the cost per unit. Might be something to contemplate as this moves forward. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, on Section 4, and I didn't go over that in the bill, that applies to the Housing Challenge Grant Program, and the Housing Challenge Grant Program provides financing for affordable housing that has income limits. And so what this section does is says if a city wants to use a challenge grant, they could also use the workforce housing TIF, but the income limits in the challenge grant would control. So if you don't use the challenge grant, it could be for any type of housing. If the city wants to use a challenge grant, then it would have to follow those income limits.
Oh, I see. Okay, that clears that up. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stump. Thank you, Mr. Hines. Thank you, members, for the conversation. Chair will lay Senate File 668 over for possible inclusion. Senator Ress, would you chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stumpf brings us. Senate File 838. You just see that again. Oh, yes. Dealing with the budget reserve. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 838 has two provisions. The first provision on page 1, line 16, is to bring the budget reserve that's in statute up to what the current budget reserve is. This is important because this is the dollar amount that determines the way the reserves are paid back if they're ever, if we ever go into deficit where there's an allotment or other changes or shifts that go up forward, what gets paid back first. And so this is the provision that's in the tax committee's jurisdiction, is to make the budget reserve number, bring it in line with what is actually being carried in the budget reserve. The other change in here is on page 2, line 18. This date change is also being carried in the finance committee, but they've asked to carry it in two places. This is a date change so that as the budget reserve calculation is taking place, any changes that occurred during the legislative session would be taken into account. And so we're changing from January 15th to August 31st.
Senator Skoy, are there any amendments?
No.
Is there discussion on Senate File 838 or comments or questions of Senator Skoy? Is there anyone who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 838. For possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Oh, it's not a motion. I do it differently in that division. Sorry. Anyway,
right.
It's laid over. Senator Skoy, did you have further comment before we adjourn?
Madam Chair and members, committee will be meeting Wednesday and Thursday at 8:30 both days. Wednesday is Border Cities statewide levy. There's a few bills dealing with that. We have the Sustainable Forestry Initiative bill for Wednesday. Thursday will be the department policy and technical bills and the dependent care credit bills. I think we're done, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
Finally.
Thanks for helping my little